Daniel is prepared to change the horizon of Jewish belief and to learn from other races in the course of recovering national political obligations of Judaism.
The Tikva Fund presents The Political Vision of Daniel Deronda, Separateness with Communication, the eighth episode of an eight-part series on George Eliot's classic novel, Daniel Deronda, led by Professor Ruth Weiss.
It's in the final chapters that we see the resolution of this novel around the idea of separation with communication. At this point, we've come to understand more about what that really means for the characters involved and for the ideas involved. It means that one will not have an amalgamation, that the ideal of human life is not everyone coming together in one neat, happy, combined, integrated oneness, but that rather maturity depends on our ability to sustain the differences among us and to develop those differences, not for their own sake, but for what each of these differences carries. Being an Englishman means something, and I think that George Eliot was worried about the degree to which the English were losing the content of their Englishness, were losing their love for England, their connection to the land, their own idea of their own past and present and future, and that this reflected itself in the weakening of family life and in the weakening of being able to argue for your own position and in the fact that the aristocracy no longer had a function, etc., etc. At the same time, she saw this in the life of the Jews, that the Jews were very threatened by assimilation, by acculturation, by the weakening of ties to the past, and the weakening of a hope for a collective Jewish future. So separation with communication then becomes the ideal of two peoples, each being able to realize its own mission. And that the Jews perhaps, because they were in so much greater danger than other peoples, that the Jews would perhaps be able to show the way of how a people could liberate itself and reclaim its sovereignty to a much greater degree than it had done in past centuries. In George Eliot's most political novel, Felix Holt, there is this line that says, "There is no private life which has not been determined by a wider public life." And I think that this is one of the things that George Eliot's fiction so brilliantly shows us. The private life embedded in the public life, in the historical life, in the much larger picture. But I think our reminder here, and the reminder I would like to make to myself as well, is that this book shows us something equally profound, that there is no national life which has not been determined by a private life, by private lives. And we will not have done justice to the way in which the private lives of these individuals are the national story, and how one can see the importance of the individual is paramount here. So I think that one should keep in mind that even though we are emphasizing the degree to which this has to do with national problems and with nationalism and with these ideas that are germinating and coming to fruition, fruit and seed is the last chapter, still, I think it's very important to remind ourselves how refined this is in drawing our attention to individual life, individual morality, individual expectations, choices, and all else. Okay, so here as we end this discussion of the novel, I think that we feel the same pressure that the novelist is under when she must in some way resolve the strands of this story that has until now been opening up and expanding. In a novel of ideas, I think this means summarizing the ideas in dramatic form. But if one of those ideas is the complexity of life, all the strands of history and of personal life, we shouldn't expect an absolutely neat conclusion. Some of the ideas of the book do emerge with bell-like clarity, I think, at least two of them. In the concluding chapter, when Gwendolyn and Deronda part, and when Deronda and Mira and Mordechai are poised to leave for the land of Israel. And the most obvious of these is the call for the Jewish people to fulfill its historic destiny by returning to its ancestral home in the land of Israel. At the end of the Passover Seder, Jews recite the phrase, "next year in Jerusalem." And this novel ends with the happily joined couple fulfilling that promise. Now, the narrator seems to know that what we are being offered is a fairy tale ending. So this is how this chapter gives us the picture. So when the bridal veil was around Mira, it hid no doubtful tremors, only a thrill of awe at the acceptance of a great gift which required great uses. And the velvet canopy never covered a more goodly bride and bridegroom to whom their people might more wisely wish offspring. More truthful lips never touched the sacramental marriage wine. The marriage blessing never gathered stronger promise of fulfillment than the integrity of their mutual pledge. Naturally, they were married according to the Jewish rite, and so on. Naturally there, meaning in two senses, of course, it's obvious that they would be married under the Jewish marriage canopy, and that they were married naturally in the way that Jews get married, which wouldn't necessarily have been familiar to the readers. When George Eliot is talking in the voice of Leonora Helm Eberstein in that phenomenal scene where she represents her own self and her own frustrations and anger, you notice that there are words that are strictly Jewish terms. Mezuzah, tefillin. It's appropriate that she should be using them because she's exposing that part of herself which she has been suppressing all those years. But when she is here describing this scene for the general reader, she does not want to use a terminology that is alienating to that reader. And this is something that if you write for an English reader, if Jews write for an English reader, this is always a decision that one has to make. Are you going to use the internal language and then with footnotes or with in italics, or are you going to write so that it is immediately comprehensible? And we see how delicately George Eliot handles both sides of this depending on the context. So in any case, the fairy tale style of the writing conveys that we are expected to regard this as an ideal conclusion, almost as though the book were moving at this point from the realm of realism to wish fulfillment. And this is not done ironically. From the very start of the novel, and with mounting emphasis, marital union has been inextricably bound up with the national consolidation. And here, the two strands of the personal choice and the national satisfaction are formally joined. And I think we are all invited to say about this conclusion, and they saw that it was good. It's important to note that the bride and groom are also accompanied by gifts and various levels of blessing from those whom they leave behind. The presents at the wedding or the wishes of the Meiriks, the Klezmers, the Malingers, confirm that all have made their peace with this outcome. And Gwendolyn writes, "It shall be better with me because I have known you." And Mordechai, who dies before they can set out together, is certain that in Deronda, his spirit will live on. He says, "Where thou goest, Daniel, I shall go," quoting Ruth, but inverting the roles of the leader and the follower. Ruth, of course, followed her mother-in-law, Naomi, into the Jewish people. Mordechai, who has been inducting Daniel into the Jewish people, now relegates himself to the role of precursor, since it will take a real political leader to bring about this new phase in Jewish history. So, like Moses, Mordechai, who calls for the restoration of Zion, does not reach the land to which he has guided the others. George Eliot was not about to imagine a triumphal return to Herzl's Altneuland. She only points us in the direction of national consolidation. The visionary Mordechai Ezra is certain that he has breathed his soul into Deronda in the way that the work of Moses was left to be carried out by Joshua. And he even uses the words that point to Moses: death is coming to me as the divine kiss, which is both parting and reunion. You see in all these echoes also how deeply immersed George Eliot was at this point in Jewish sources and biblical sources and post-biblical sources, Midrashim and so forth. So this ending of the novel corresponded, I think, exactly to the historical reality that the implementation of this ideal was yet to come. The Bilu movement of Jewish settlement began in 1881, and the Zionist movement was founded 2 decades after this book appeared. But the parting from Gwendolyn that comes before this ending speaks to a second idea that accompanies the first. If we've been paying attention, there are not one, but 2 spokesmen for the idea of Jewish nationalism: Mordechai the visionary and Daniel Charizi, the grandfather for whom Daniel Deronda is named. Both men, Mordechai and the grandfather, are equally passionate, some would say extreme, in their single-minded concentration on the destiny of the Jewish people. One is consumed by visions of the future, the other is intent on transmitting the past, on forging links, very strong links, in what was called, and in Yiddish is famously called, always referred to as die goldene Kette, the golden chain of Jewish tradition. So Charizi's insistence on the continuity of the Jewish people is received and registered in Deronda's interviews with his mother and with Joseph Kalonymus. Daniel learns from both his mother and from this friend of his grandfather's that his grandfather's intelligence was yoked to an iron will that made him formidable even to his friend, let alone to his daughter. What the daughter repudiates, the friend admires in someone whom he considers far better than himself. And he says, Daniel Charizi used to say, better a wrong will than a wavering, better a steadfast enemy than an uncertain friend, better a false belief than no belief at all. What he despised most was indifference. It's rather strong, right? Better a steadfast enemy than an uncertain friend. This goes a long way to showing what zealotry is. So the novel shows the ambiguous effect of such zealotry, since what a friend can accept doesn't work that well on a child. Leonora found her father to be tyrannical, and by trying to force his daughter into believing as he did, he drove her all the way into conversion. That will of iron may have worked in earlier generations when parental and communal authority was taken for granted. But once emancipation gave men and women the power to escape its grip, Leonora takes advantage of her father's death to break the chain that is to her not golden, but imprisoning, not inspiring, but inhibiting. Nonetheless, there it is. Her father's will to perpetuate the Jewish people works from beyond the grave as his friend makes sure that Charizi's legacy is passed on to its rightful heir. So zealotry is the force that retains, repels, and retrieves. At the same time, though, this is the crux of it, we are assured that our Daniel, Charizi's grandson, is markedly different in his nature and approach to people and to his people. Deronda worries lest his grandfather's knowledge was too narrow. Going forward within a new political context, of rights and freedoms, this idea of Jewish national liberation will have to work through persuasion rather than command. Without Charizi's tenacity, there would have been no Jewish people. But modern Jews want to live as a people out in the open, on equal terms with other nations. In this case, in equal terms with the British. And again, parenthetically, we should keep in mind that ghetto was not originally imposed from without. You know, we use the word ghetto now, of course, in its pejorative sense. The Nazis forced the Jews into ghettos. But my great teacher, Max Weinreich, in his History of the Yiddish Language, makes a point of emphasizing, and other historians do so as well, Jews voluntarily separated themselves. No one is forcing the Jews of Lakewood into Lakewood. No one is forcing the Jews of Muncie here into Muncie, or in Israel into B'nai Brak. These are voluntary communities, which then really could have been turned negatively into ghettos, but this was separate. However, in the case of Daniel, this is a Jew who would like his nationalism to be out there in the open, on equal terms with the British. So the call for Jewish nationalism in this novel has to be bound up with another idea that only gradually emerges and affects the balance that Durandi must achieve between his English upbringing and his future as a Jew. We never learn precisely what the chest contains that belonged to Daniel Charizi and was retrieved by Joseph Kalonymus to be handed over to the grandson. But Durandi receives through this friend the teaching. And here we, the readers, are meant to ingest this teaching as well. What Daniel Charizi used to insist on was that the strength and wealth of mankind depended on the balance of separateness and communication. And he was bitterly against our people losing themselves among the Gentiles. It's no better, said he, than that many sorts of grain going back from their variety into sameness. Always a kind of metaphor that is used. What would you like? All the varieties of animal life to be reduced to one? Of course not. So therefore, you would want separateness so that each distinctive tribe, each distinctive national community can remain somehow separate. Okay, but after this, when Durandi is asked by Kalonymus about his profession, what are you going to make of your life? He suddenly finds that he has an answer that he could not have given Sir Hugo several years earlier when he was asked the same question. The text says, it happened to Durandi at that moment, as it has often happened to others, that the need for speech made an epoch in resolve. His respect for the questioner would not let him decline to answer, and by the necessity to answer, he found out the truth for himself. And that answer repeats the phrase that Daniel has just heard. I shall call myself a Jew, said Durandi deliberately, becoming slightly paler under the piercing eyes of his questioner. But I will not say that I shall profess to believe exactly as my fathers have believed. Our fathers themselves changed the horizon of their belief and learned of other races. But I think I can maintain my grandfather's notion of separateness with communication. I hold that my first duty is to my own people, and if there is anything to be done toward restoring or perfecting their common life, I shall make that my vocation. So, Daniel is prepared to change the horizon of Jewish belief and to learn from other races in the course of recovering national political obligations of Judaism. If you pay attention to this in particular, you can see how many people in this novel take the trouble of actually explaining themselves to the other person and how much the theme of communication matters. Not just knowing who you are, but being able to explain it and really almost judging people's moral status by the degree to which they are able to do that. And Daniel Durandi, when he is told this by Kalonymus, is told about this theme of separation with communication, says right in response, "Oh, yes, but I will have to separate myself slightly differently from the way in which my grandfather did this. My situation is going to be a little bit different, and I am going to really realize that ideal of separateness with communication, but in my own terms." And here is really this extraordinary insight of George Eliot's. By the end of the novel, we really do understand, without him even making the connection, how different it's going to be, because he understands that the old ways of his grandfather were not going to work. And one of the reasons that Jews would have to reclaim their national sovereignty in the land of Israel is because one would have to find a new expression for that same desire to remain a people apart. It was not working in Europe any longer. The idea of the Jews remaining a separate entity amidst another people that was trying to realize its nationality, what George Eliot saw on the continent frightened her. What she saw in England frightened her. What she saw was growing anti-Semitism, that at the same time that you had resurgence of national feeling, this too often came with the idea of being against the alien in our midst. And the chief alien was bound to be the Jew, because he did not have a land of his own. So if the Scots came to Poland and they settled there as a community, there was not so much worry about it, because they could always go back to Scotland. And the same was true of other minorities. The Jews, however, were considered to be much more of a threat, because they seemed to be sort of permanently in your midst. And they did so well sometimes in your midst. So they came to be perceived more and more in Europe, and now beginning to be more and more in England as well, as a threat. George Eliot considered this a threat to the British. It's not only that she saw how threatening this was physically to the Jews, she saw this as being threatening to the British conception of what England was going to be. Imagine a xenophobic England. Imagine an England which considered the aliens in your midst an enemy. So part of this theme of separation with communication really had to do with the fact that the Jews would have to make themselves into an independent, separate people. He declines not just the approach of reform, which we've spoken about, but he also declines the approach of defensive orthodoxy by claiming the right to live as a Jew in contact with other peoples. And perhaps if his grandfather emphasizes the separateness of that phrase, he will emphasize the qualifier, with communication. So this principle of separateness with communication, I think, is no less prominent an idea here than the idea of Jewish nationalism itself. And it pertains equally to the British and Jewish parts of the novel and offers the rationale for their coexistence. And incidentally, one could say, if you read its charter, that the balance between nationalism or separateness and coexistence or communication is the basis of the Charter of the United Nations. So what does Daniel mean when he says that he thinks he can maintain the grandfather's notion of separateness with communication? A classic hero is someone victorious in a struggle. The Talmud says it is someone who conquers his evil impulse, or who conquers the struggle within himself. And what would the wrong impulse have been here? The wrong impulse in Daniel would have been to marry Gwendolyn. Have we come to an understanding of why such a marriage would be wrong? Well, according to the Gentiles in this book, it would have been right and commendable. After all, when the arrow points accept the marriage of Klesmer to their daughter, isn't that a good thing? Don't we feel that they and their society have overcome their prejudice by accepting the marriage of a Jew and a Gentile? So how can we justify Daniel's rejection of the very thing that we commend and welcome as tolerance? So the attraction between Klesmer and Catherine Arrowpoint occurs in the higher echelons of society, where Christianity is taken with so little seriousness that any lingering prejudice against the Jews would have been unwarranted snobbish residue. Where religion and ethnicity matters to neither, teacher and student are drawn together through devotion not only to one another, but to a higher calling of musical excellence, musical perfection. They are not indifferent to society or necessarily cut off from the affairs of state. You see, Klezmer speaks of music as a counterpart of governance. These two will join one another and enrich the nation through their music. Had their romance featured any talk of church, any talk of conversion to Christianity, or the subordination of Judaism to Christianity, it would have raised questions that do become legitimate when faith and national passions are real. However, this is taking place at a time when liberal ideals were beginning to blur religious and ethnic differences among those for whom these differences were no longer essential. And Klezmer often affirms that his highest obligation is to music, and his partnership with Catherine is understood to be such a marriage between two glorious musicians. Like Daniel and Mira, husband and wife unite in a cause beyond themselves. Their marriage breaks down what have become for others merely, and for them, merely artificial barriers of class. So see how complex this book is. Even though it is so strongly against this meeting at the very beginning, consummating itself by the end, I think it does not in any way repudiate Klezmer and Catherine's marriage, understanding that the same things are not important for everyone, but the main thing about the Klezmers is that they are not like Grand Court, cynical about society. Society is not for them brutes. They are not without values. They've simply moved to another category of values, so they can be integrated into the nation on different terms. Yet, if the first step in the advancement of a healthy society is to give up its prejudices, a people is no less in need of leaders who devote themselves not to the perfection of music, but to the perfection of the people, to the perfection of the nation. And that too is an art, and one of great importance in democratic societies. So Deronda declares himself in the service of his people in the same way that our politicians profess to be working or fighting for you. I am fighting for you, you know, the more you look at these. But the better politicians actually do so when they are in office. When Sir Hugo and Deronda's teacher first put the question to him about his choice of profession, Deronda is not at all certain what he wants to do or to become. The novel traces his evolution from an uncertain young man into someone wholly directed towards a goal for which we have seen that he is suited. The British have a parliament. If you want to lead Britain, you go into government. The Jews of the 1860s as yet lacked national sovereignty. So they had first to generate the leaders who would create the Jewish polity that could then fully govern itself. To be that leader, Deronda would have to be true to both Mordechai's visionary ideal of a reconstituted Jewish people in the land of Israel and to his grandfather's emphasis on retention, on transmission of Jewish tradition through kinship and material possessions, like a family ring and a treasure chest of family documents. But look, we see that such transmission is much less stable than in the past. The defection of a single person can interrupt family life stretching back through generations. Just as Gwendolyn is without firm enough roots in Offendene, Daniel must search very hard to reconnect with the family that essentially gave him up for adoption. And much of his ability to recover the lost Jewish connections depends on accidental encounters. Daniel's with Mira before he sees Gwendolyn Harleth. Think of what would have happened if he had met them in reverse order. Or Daniel's seeing Kalonymus in the Frankfurt synagogue. It takes so much grit and tenacity for him to withstand all of those who want to wrap him in their embrace. He has to risk the loss of friendship with Hans, the disapproval of his guardian, the affection of Gwendolyn. And even the artifacts that are transmitted cannot be relied on. The chest could so easily have been lost. And even when it is retrieved, Daniel has to find someone else to read its contents. He can't read them himself. The family ring is stolen by his future father-in-law. So going forward, the idea of Jewish nationalism is going to have to shore itself up. And it's going to shore itself up in its national homeland, because in every conceivable way, modernity, the best and the worst trends in modernity, will otherwise undermine the foundations of the Jewish people. And yet, Daniel cannot stop being an Englishman. Mira's repertoire will be largely European. She's a singer, but her repertoire, yes, she has that one song, the lullaby from her mother, but most of her repertoire is European. If these Jews do restore their homeland, those who developed the modern idea and impulse for nationalism are going to inevitably want to remain associated with the countries most like their own. And what about the English? They are familiar with the model of Jews being absorbed and familiar with the model of allegedly wicked Jews being condemned and expelled. But they must now move to a model of fruitful coexistence, more than coexistence, communication. Can the Jews be tolerated not as individuals, but as an equal polity? Will the British perceive that as a threat? Will the British perceive that as a threat to their national cohesion? How can the fervor of one people not threaten the identity and the integrity of the other? The answer lies with the ability of the larger power to accept the independence of the smaller, and with the ability of the smaller to affirm its independence from the larger. The British would have to accept, just as Gwendolyn does, under protest and with difficulty, the need for Jews to be a separate people following their own way of life that is centered in their own homeland. The finest among the Jews will now have to lead the reclamation of land in body as well as in spirit, and the finest among the English will have to wish them well and lend them every encouragement. So, a Jew, Gwendolyn exclaims when Daniel tells her what he has learned from his mother. But then she recovers nicely, and she reacts pretty much as he did when Mira first told him that she was a Jewess. What difference need that have made? Adding, I hope there is nothing to make you mind. You are just the same as if you were not a Jew. And the text tells us she meant to assure him that nothing of that external sort could affect the way in which she regarded him or the way in which he could influence her. Now that might have been good enough for Klezmer, who treats his Judaism as something of that external sort and wants only to ensure that as a Jew he is not belittled. But if Deronda wants more than her indifference, he is going to have to make himself known. He's going to have to make himself understood. So he says, I am going to the East to become better acquainted with the condition of my race in various countries there, said Deronda gently, anxious to be as explanatory as he could on what was the impersonal part of their separateness from each other. And then he continues, the idea that I am possessed with is that of restoring a political existence to my people, making them a nation again, giving them a national center such as the English have, though they too are scattered over the face of the globe. That is a task which presents itself to me as a duty. I am resolved to begin it, however feebly. I am resolved to devote my life to it. At the least, I may awaken a movement in other minds, such as has been awakened in my own. So taking the trouble to explain, as well as he is able, the impersonal part of their separateness from one another is as important as restoring political existence to his people, because he does not want to lessen the attachment between them, or the attachment to his guardian, or to the English. Hence again, the phrase with communication is as necessary as the noun separateness. Daniel's intention coincides with that of the novel, obviously, which is to provide the explanation and to facilitate the communication that will bring about Jewish sovereignty and that will make it unexceptional once the Jews have reinforced their standing as a modern nation. The threat of the English, who were becoming so much more anti-Semitic as she saw it, politely anti-Semitic in polite society, cruelly anti-Semitic in cruel society. She saw it on all levels, and really this theme of separation with communication is really letting us solve the problem before it became as acute as it ultimately became in Europe. I think that without reading forward into history, which one doesn't want to do with a novel, one has to ask oneself, supposing people had seen what George Eliot saw when she saw it in the 1870s, can you imagine if the Zionist movement had begun at that time and was already 20 years advanced by the time Theodor Herzl called the first Zionist Congress in 1897? Can you imagine how differently the Jewish fate would have emerged in the 20th century? And one has to think of the other two. Imagine if Britain had been wise enough not only to give the Balfour Declaration, which many people thought George Eliot had a role in laying the groundwork for, not just that, but supposing they had understood that Palestine, the land of Israel, was the land of the Jewish people. Suppose that in the 1930s, instead of at the worst point in Jewish history, preventing Jews from coming to the land of Israel, supposing Britain had understood its role, its mandate, as allowing, encouraging Jews to come to the land of Israel. The British contempt for Jewish national self-determination was one of the things that influenced world opinion at a time when it mattered more than ever before. So George Eliot was, in this sense, prophetic, but my feeling has always been that a prophet is someone who sees what is happening in their time. And George Eliot saw better than anyone else of her circle, perhaps better than anyone else of her time. Now this term normalization that was used by the Zionists to describe their goal in wanting to reclaim their sovereignty in their national homeland is often misunderstood, even by those who use the term. Normalization did not condemn the Jews to becoming like the English or like any other people, because that would have defeated the very purpose of a separate Jewish people. What could normal mean anyway, when there were so many different kinds of countries and nations? The term meant that Jews would become politically unexceptional by having their own country again, as other nations did. Jews could then live in other countries as expatriates rather than homeless migrants. The goal of attaining this homeland depended on persuading the Jews to make the effort and persuading the English to understand its necessity, to bless the project, and to keep the warm lines of communication open, as they continued to do with the United States when America actually broke away from the motherland. If Britain could let the colonies go after a revolutionary war, then they could certainly understand the Jewish need for independence, not as rejection of England, but as a development necessary for both parties. And here is it. Necessary for both parties. This too was sometimes underappreciated, even by those who made the case for Zionism. The rise of the modern hep, hep, hep of anti-Jewish politics threatened the project of emancipation. And this antipathy toward the Jews was not worthy of the British nation. Britain's record of anti-Jewish actions was at odds with its self-image as a supremely civilized country. So if the Jews become a nation like the others, they would no longer be perceived as a threatening nation within a nation. Thus everything depended on Daniel's ability to lead his people home, and on Gwendolyn's ability to wish him well while, quote, living to be one of the best of women. This is her ambition. I want to live to be, this is what she says in that letter, to be one of the best of women. From Mordechai, the vision, from Charizi, the tenacity, between Daniel and Gwendolyn, the ability to forge separateness with communication. Now, George Eliot foresaw and wrote into the novel some of the reactions to her book that would that this kind of idea, these kind of ideas would provoke. The most benign kind of negative reaction is probably that of poor Sir Hugo, who thought that he had rescued Deronda from the Jewishness the boy now wishes to adopt. I've long expected something remarkable from you, Dan, but for God's sake, don't go into any eccentricities. He warns Dan against engaging in lunatic behavior. At this stage of the world, if a man wants to be taken seriously, he must keep clear of melodrama. What he means by this stage of the world is clearly that the rational assumption that European civilization in British form now has to spread across the globe, and what he means by melodrama is this passion for propagating the Jews. He also preys on Daniel's guilt when he says, I hope you are not going to set a dead Jew above a living Christian. So Sir Hugo's reaction, I think, anticipates the incomprehension of critics with these kind of mildly chauvinistic predispositions. The most malign negative reaction, so ignorant and anachronistic that the author could not have foreseen it, is the accusation increasingly mounted against this text that she neglected to take into account the Arabs living in the land of Israel. Well, it was the Turks who ruled Palestine in Eliot's day, and since the British administered other parts of Asia, the Jewish movement for self-rule would have been perceived as part of a common struggle of colonized nations against imperialism. Ironically, the book is accused of denying any reality to the people of the East by giving no thought to the actual residents of Palestine, and this is sort of quotations, exemplifying the ethnocentric rationale that was at the heart of imperialist hegemony. This is how this author of ours is being characterized. Yet for anti-colonialist George Eliot, it was the Jewish struggle against being colonized that deserved special attention. The British had treated the Jews badly for far too long, and the land of Israel had been under foreign occupation for even longer. She wished there to be no more crusades with Christians and Muslims fighting over a land that belonged to neither. This is what she sees, right? So separation between liberal democracies implies no lessening of mutual affection, but it requires making a real effort at mutual understanding. So far, the Jews are the ones who have had to work hard at understanding the English. The English would now be expected to understand the Jews. Many have speculated on the reasons for the author's creation of Daniel Deronda, and they've looked for the answer in her attraction to Judaism, which was profound. But the novel was also a response to what its author evidently perceived as an emerging threat to liberal democracy in England and to a certain conception of liberalism itself. Tolerance becomes intolerance when it is prepared to absorb others, to intermarry with others, without being conscious of the unwillingness of others to be absorbed, to intermarry with them. So British democracy was not going to mature unless and until it learned to appreciate separateness with communication, a liberality that did not want to absorb the Jews, but to learn their wisdom and their ways. So I will conclude by letting George Eliot speak for herself on this subject, writing as a philosopher this time, rather than a novelist, in the last of her published essays, written after the last of her novels. The last of her published essays, I think, is that modern Hep, 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 that astonishing essay on anti-Semitism, which I commend to you. It's very, all of it is very rich. But here is a passage where she speaks of the connection that she has made on these grounds. A common humanity is not yet enough to feed the rich blood of various activity which makes a complete man. And by the way, man there in that context is always used to mean person, right? The time is not come for cosmopolitanism to be highly virtuous any more than for communism to suffice for social energy. I am not bound to feel for a Chinaman as I feel for my fellow countrymen. I am bound not to demoralize him with opium, not to compel him to my will by destroying or plundering the fruits of his labor on the alleged ground that he is not cosmopolitan enough, and not to insult him for his want of my tailoring and my religion when he appears as a peaceable visitor on the London pavement. It is admirable in a Briton with a good purpose to learn Chinese, but it would not be a proof of fine intellect in him to taste Chinese poetry in the original more than he tastes the poetry of his own tongue. Affection, intelligence, duty radiate from a center. And nature has decided that for us English folk, that center can be neither China nor Peru. Most of us feel this unreflectingly. What is wanting is that we should recognize a corresponding attachment to nationality as legitimate in every other people and understand that its absence is a privation of the greatest good. And since Jews have been deprived of that greatest good, and since Jews are the ones, in her understanding, who have suffered the most from having been deprived of that greatest good, Daniel Deronda is the magnificent writer's attempt to restore this good to them. So that's, I think, what the book does. Thank you. When all is said and done, I guess that this novel, almost more than any other that I know, reminds me of why, of all the fields of knowledge that one could have gone into, I chose to go into literature. I understood that there were other important fields, history, very important, philosophy, very important, psychology, an emerging field, very interesting, anthropology, and so forth. There were really many disciplines to choose among, and more were being opened up as I made my own choices. But nothing seemed to me more important than literature, because it was, as the Talmud says, turn it and turn it, and everything is in it. And I was not privileged to study Talmud, because Talmud was not taught to girls when I went to school. And so the closest thing I found in it was modern literature, and particularly the modern novel at its greatest, which tried to encompass everything. And the novel of ideas, which really starts out with a strong moral proposition and then tries to embody that in human form, in and in societal form, this was magical to me and extremely inspiring. And so it is a great privilege to be able to teach Daniel Deronda, which I think exemplifies this more than almost any other novel I know.
For additional information about the Tikva Fund, please visit tikvafund.org.